This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Peak, Secrets from the New Science of Expertise, written by Anders Ericsson and Robert Poole, performed by Sean Renett. Introduction. The Gift. Why are some people so amazingly good at what they do? Anywhere you look, from competitive sports and musical performance to science, medicine, and business, there always seem to be a few exceptional sorts who dazzle us with what they can do and how well they do it. And when we are confronted with such an exceptional person, we naturally tend to conclude that this person was born with something a little extra. He is so gifted, we say, or she has a real gift. But is that really so? For more than 30 years, I have studied these people, the special ones who stand out as experts in their fields. Athletes, musicians, chess players, doctors, salespeople, teachers, and more. I have delved into the nuts and bolts of what they do and how they do it. I have observed, interviewed, and tested them. I have explored the psychology, the physiology, and the neuroanatomy of these extraordinary people. And over time, I've come to understand that yes, these people do have an extraordinary gift, which lies at the heart of their capabilities. But it is not the gift that people usually assume it to be, and it is even more powerful than we imagine. Most importantly, it is a gift that every one of us is born with and can, with the right approach, take advantage of. The Lesson of Perfect Pitch. The year is 1763, and a young Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart is about to embark on a tour around Europe that will jumpstart the Mozart legend. Just 7 years old and barely tall enough to see over the top of the harpsichord, he captivates audiences in his hometown of Salzburg with his skill on the violin and various keyboard instruments. He plays with a facility that seems impossible to believe in someone so young. But Mozart has another trick up his sleeve that is, if anything, even more surprising to the people of his era. We know about this talent, because it was described in a rather breathless letter to the editor about the young Mozart that was published in a newspaper in Augsburg, Mozart's father's hometown, shortly before Mozart and his family left Salzburg for their tour. The letter writer reported that when the young Mozart heard a note played on a musical instrument, any note, he could immediately identify exactly which note it was. The A sharp in the second octave above middle C, perhaps, or the E flat below middle C. Mozart could do this even if he was in another room and could not see the instrument being played, and he could do it not just for the violin and forte piano, but for every instrument he heard. And Mozart's father, as a composer and music teacher, had nearly every imaginable musical instrument in his house. Nor was it just musical instruments. The boy could identify the notes produced by anything that was sufficiently musical. The chime of a clock, the toll of a bell, the achoo of a sneeze. It was an ability that most adult musicians of the time, even the most experienced, could not match. And it seemed, even more than Mozart's skill on keyboard and violin, to be an example of the mysterious gifts that this young prodigy had been born with. That ability is not quite so mysterious to us today, of course. We know a good deal more about it now than 250 years ago. And most people today have at least heard of it. The technical term is absolute pitch, although it is better known as perfect pitch, and it is exceptionally rare. Only about one in every 10,000 people has it. It is much less rare among world-class musicians than among the rest of us, but even among virtuosos, it is far from normal. Beethoven is thought to have had it, Brahms did not. Vladimir Horowitz had it, Igor Stravinsky did not. Frank Sinatra had it. Miles Davis did not. It would seem, in short, to be a perfect example of an innate talent that a few lucky people are born with and most are not. Indeed, this is what was widely believed for at least 200 years. But over the past few decades, a very different understanding of perfect pitch has emerged, one that points to an equally different vision of the sorts of gifts that life has to offer. The first hint emerged with the observation that the only people who had received this gift had also received some sort of musical training early in their childhood. In particular, a good deal of research has shown that nearly everyone with perfect pitch began musical training at a very young age, generally around 3 to 5 years old. But if perfect pitch is an innate ability, something that you were either born with or not, then it shouldn't make any difference whether you receive musical training as a child. All that should matter is that you get enough musical training at any time in your life to learn the names of the notes. The next clue appeared when researchers noticed that perfect pitch is much more common among people who speak a tonal language, such as Mandarin, Vietnamese, and several other Asian tongues, in which the meaning of words is dependent on their pitch. If perfect pitch is indeed a genetic gift, then the only way that the tonal language connection would make sense would be if people of Asian ancestry are more likely to have genes for perfect pitch than people whose ancestors came from elsewhere, such as Europe or Africa. But that is something that is easy to test for. You just recruit a number of people of Asian ancestry who grew up speaking English or some other non-tonal language and see if they are more likely to have perfect pitch. That research has been done, and it turns out that people of Asian heritage who don't grow up speaking a tonal language are no more likely than people of other ethnicities to have perfect pitch. So it's not the Asian genetic heritage, but rather learning a tonal language that makes having perfect pitch more likely. Up until a few years ago, this was pretty much what we knew. Studying music as a child was thought to be essential to having perfect pitch, and growing up speaking a tonal language increased your odds of having perfect pitch. Scientists could not say with any certainty whether perfect pitch was an innate talent, but they knew that if it was a gift, it was a gift that only appeared among those people who had received some training in pitch in childhood. In other words, it would have to be some sort of use-it-or-lose-it gift. Even the lucky few people who were born with a gift for perfect pitch would have to do something, in particular some sort of musical training while young, to develop it. We now know that this isn't the case either. The true character of perfect pitch was revealed in 2014, thanks to a beautiful experiment carried out at the Ichiyonkai Music School in Tokyo and reported in the scientific journal Psychology of Music. The Japanese psychologist Ayako Sakakibara recruited 24 children between the ages of 2 and 6 and put them through a months-long training course designed to teach them to identify, simply by their sound, various chords played on the piano. The chords were all major chords with 3 notes, such as a C major chord with middle C and the E and G notes immediately above middle C. The children were given 4 or 5 short training sessions per day, each lasting just a few minutes. And each child continued training until he or she could identify all 14 of the target chords that Sakakibara had selected. Some of the children completed the training in less than a year, while others took as long as a year and a half. Then, once a child had learned to identify the 14 chords, Sakakibara tested that child to see if he or she could correctly name individual notes. After completing training, every one of the children in the study had developed perfect pitch and could identify individual notes played on the piano. This is an astonishing result. While in normal circumstances only 1 in every 10,000 people develops perfect pitch, every single one of Sakakibara's students did. The clear implication is that perfect pitch, far from being a gift bestowed upon only a lucky few, is an ability that pretty much anyone can develop with the right exposure and training. The study has completely rewritten our understanding of perfect pitch. So what about Mozart's perfect pitch? A little investigation into his background gives us a pretty good idea of what happened. Wolfgang's father, Leopold Mozart, was a moderately talented violinist and composer who never had the degree of success he desired, so he set out to turn his children into the sort of musicians he himself had always wanted to be. He began with Mozart's older sister, Maria Anna, who by the time she was 11 was described by contemporaries as playing the piano and harpsichord as well as professional adult musicians. The elder Mozart, who wrote the first training book for children's musical development, began working with Wolfgang at an even earlier age than he had started with Maria Anna. By the time Wolfgang was 4, his father was working with him full-time, on the violin, the keyboard, and more. While we don't know exactly what exercises Mozart's father used to train his son, we do know that by the time Mozart was 6 or 7, he had trained far more intensely and for far longer than the 24 children who developed perfect pitch through Sakakibara's practice sessions. In retrospect, then, there should be nothing at all surprising about Mozart's development of perfect pitch. So did the 7-year-old Wolfgang have a gift for perfect pitch? Yes and no. Was he born with some rare genetic endowment that allowed him to identify the precise pitch of a piano note or a whistling tea kettle? Everything that scientists have learned about perfect pitch says no. Indeed, if Mozart had been raised in some other family without exposure to music, or without enough of the right sort of exposure, he would certainly have never developed that ability at all. Nonetheless, Mozart was indeed born with a gift, and it was the same gift that the children in Sakakibara's study were born with. They were all endowed with a brain so flexible and adaptable that it could, with the right sort of training, develop a capability that seems quite magical to those of us who do not possess it. In short, perfect pitch is not the gift, but rather the ability to develop perfect pitch is the gift. And as nearly as we can tell, pretty much everyone is born with that gift. This is a wonderful and surprising fact. In the millions of years of evolution leading up to modern humans, there were almost certainly no selection pressures favoring people who could identify, say, the precise notes that a bird was singing. Yet here we are today, able to develop perfect pitch with a relatively simple training regimen. Only recently have neuroscientists come to understand why such a gift should exist. For decades, scientists believed that we were born with our brain's circuits pretty much fixed, and that this circuitry determined our abilities. Either your brain was wired for perfect pitch, or it wasn't, and there wasn't much you could do to change it. You might need a certain amount of practice to bring that innate talent into full bloom, and if you didn't get this practice, your perfect pitch might never develop fully. But the general belief was that no amount of practice would help if you didn't have the right genes to start with. But since the 1990s, brain researchers have come to realize that the brain, even the adult brain, is far more adaptable than anyone ever imagined, and this gives us a tremendous amount of control over what our brains are able to do. In particular, the brain responds to the right sorts of triggers by rewiring itself in various ways. New connections are made between neurons, while existing connections can be strengthened or weakened, and in some parts of the brain it is even possible for new neurons to grow. This adaptability explains how the development of perfect pitch was possible in Sakakibara's subjects, as well as in Mozart himself. Their brains responded to the musical training by developing certain circuits that enabled perfect pitch. We can't yet identify exactly which circuits those are, or say what they look like, or exactly what they do, but we know they must be there, and we know that they are the product of the training, not of some inborn genetic programming. In the case of perfect pitch, it seems that the necessary adaptability in the brain disappears by the time a child passes about 6 years old, so that if the rewiring necessary for perfect pitch has not occurred by then, it will never happen. Although, as we will see in Chapter 8, there are exceptions of a sort, and these exceptions can teach us a great deal about exactly how people take advantage of the brain's adaptability. This loss is part of a broader phenomenon, that is, that both the brain and the body are more adaptable in young children than in adults, so there are certain abilities that can only be developed, or that are more easily developed, before the age of 6 or 12 or 18. Still, both the brain and the body retain a great deal of adaptability throughout adulthood, and this adaptability makes it possible for adults, even older adults, to develop a wide variety of new capabilities with the right training. With this truth in mind, let's return to the question that I asked at the beginning. Why are some people so amazingly good at what they do? Over my years of studying experts in various fields, I have found that they all develop their abilities in much the same way that Sakakibara's students did, through dedicated training that drives changes in the brain and sometimes, depending on the ability, in the body, that make it possible for them to do things that they otherwise could not. Yes, in some cases, genetic endowment makes a difference, particularly in areas where height or other physical factors are important. A man with genes for being 5'5" will find it tough to become a professional basketball player, just as a 6-foot woman will find it virtually impossible to succeed as an artistic gymnast at the international level. And as we will discuss later in this book, there are other ways in which genes may influence one's achievements, particularly those genes that influence how likely a person is to practice diligently and correctly. But the clear message from decades of research is that no matter what role innate genetic endowment may play in the achievements of gifted people, the main gift that these people have is the same one we all have: the adaptability of the human brain and body, which they have taken advantage of more than the rest of us. If you talk to these extraordinary people, you find that they all understand this at one level or another. They may be unfamiliar with the concept of cognitive adaptability, but they seldom buy into the idea that they have reached the peak of their fields because they were the lucky winners of some genetic lottery. They know what is required to develop the extraordinary skills that they possess because they have experienced it firsthand. One of my favorite testimonies on this topic came from Ray Allen, a 10-time All-Star in the National Basketball Association and the greatest three-point shooter in the history of that league. Some years back, ESPN columnist Jackie McMullen wrote an article about Allen as he was approaching his record for the most three-point shots made. In talking with Allen for that story, McMullen mentioned that another basketball commentator had said that Allen was born with a shooting touch. In other words, an innate gift for three-pointers. Allen did not agree. "I've argued this with a lot of people in my life," he told McMullen. "When people say God blessed me with a beautiful jump shot, it really pisses me off. I tell those people, don't undermine the work I've put in every day. Not some days. Every day. Go ask anyone who's been on a team with me who shoots the most. Go back to Seattle and Milwaukee and ask them. The answer is me." And indeed, as McMullen noted, if you talk to Allen's high school basketball coach, you will find that Allen's jump shot was not noticeably better than his teammates' jump shots back then. In fact, it was poor. But Allen took control, and over time, with hard work and dedication, he transformed his jump shot into one so graceful and natural that people assumed he was born with it. He took advantage of his gift, his real gift. About this book. This is a book about the gift that Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, Sakakibara's schoolchildren, and Ray Allen all shared. The ability to create, through the right sort of training and practice, abilities that they would not otherwise possess by taking advantage of the incredible adaptability of the human brain and body. Furthermore, it is a book about how anyone can put this gift to work in order to improve in an area they choose. And finally, in the broadest sense, this is a book about a fundamentally new way of thinking about human potential. One that suggests we have far more power than we ever realized to take control of our own lives. Since antiquity, people have generally assumed that a person's potential in any given field is inevitably and unavoidably limited by that person's inherent talent. Many people take piano lessons, but only those with some special gift become truly great pianists or composers. Every child is exposed to mathematics in school, but only a few have what it takes to become mathematicians or physicists or engineers. According to this view, each of us is born with a set of fixed potentials: a potential for music, a potential for mathematics, a potential for sports, a potential for business, and we can choose to develop or not any of those potentials, but we cannot fill any of those particular cups up past its brim. Thus, the purpose of teaching or training becomes helping a person reach his or her potential, to fill the cup as fully as possible. This implies a certain approach to learning that assumes preset limits. But we now understand that there's no such thing as a predefined ability. The brain is adaptable, and training can create skills such as perfect pitch that did not exist before. This is a game changer, because learning now becomes a way of creating abilities rather than of bringing people to the point where they can take advantage of their innate ones. In this new world, it no longer makes sense to think of people as born with fixed reserves of potential. Instead, potential is an expandable vessel, shaped by the various things we do throughout our lives. Learning isn't a way of reaching one's potential, but rather a way of developing it. We can create our own potential. And this is true whether our goal is to become a concert pianist or just play the piano well enough to amuse ourselves, to join the PGA golf tour, or just bring our handicaps down a few strokes. The question then becomes, how do we do it? How do we take advantage of this gift and build abilities in our area of choice? Much of my research over the past several decades has been devoted to answering this question, that is, to identify and understand in detail the best ways to improve performance in a given activity. In short, I've been asking, what works and what doesn't, and why? Surprisingly, this question has gotten very little attention from most of the people who have written about this general subject. Over the past few years, a number of books have argued that people have been overestimating the value of innate talent and underestimating the value of such things as opportunity, motivation, and effort. I cannot disagree with this, and it is certainly important to let people know that they can improve and improve a lot with practice, or else they are unlikely to be motivated to even try. But sometimes these books leave the impression that heartfelt desire and hard work alone will lead to improved performance. Just keep working at it and you'll get there. And this is wrong. The right sort of practice, carried out over a sufficient period of time, leads to improvement. Nothing else. This book describes in detail what that right sort of practice is and how it can be put to work. The details about this sort of practice are drawn from a relatively new area of psychology that can be best described as the science of expertise. This new field seeks to understand the abilities of expert performers, that is, people who are among the very best in the world at what they do, who have reached the very peak of performance. And I've published several academic books on the topic, including Toward a General Theory of Expertise, Prospects and Limits in 1991, The Road to Excellence in 1996, and The Cambridge Handbook of Expertise and Expert Performance in 2006. Those of us in the expertise field investigate what sets these exceptional people apart from everyone else. We also try to assemble a step-by-step accounting of how these expert performers improved their performance over time and exactly how their mental and physical abilities changed as they improved. More than two decades ago, after studying expert performers from a wide range of fields, my colleagues and I came to realize that no matter what the field, the most effective approaches to improving performance all follow a single set of general principles. We named this universal approach deliberate practice. Today, deliberate practice remains the gold standard for anyone in any field who wishes to take advantage of the gift of adaptability in order to build new skills and abilities, and it is the main concern of this book. The first half of this book describes what deliberate practice is, why it works as well as it does, and how experts apply it to produce their extraordinary abilities. To do that, we will have to examine various types of practice, from the least to the most sophisticated, and discuss what differentiates them. Because one of the key differences among different types of practice is the extent to which they harness the adaptability of the human brain and body, we will take some time to discuss that adaptability and what triggers it. We'll also explore exactly what sorts of changes take place in the brain in response to deliberate practice. Because gaining expertise is largely a matter of improving one's mental processes, including in some fields the mental processes that control body movements, and because physical changes, such as increasing strength, flexibility, and endurance, are already reasonably well understood, this book's focus will be mostly on the mental side of expert performance. Although there is certainly a significant physical component to expertise in sports and other athletic endeavors. After these explorations, we will examine how everything fits together to produce an expert performer, a long-term process that generally takes a decade or more. Next, in a brief interlude, we examine more closely the issue of innate endowment and what role it might play in limiting how far some people can go in attaining expert performance. There are some inherited physical characteristics, such as height and body size, that can influence performance in various sports and other physical activities, and that cannot be changed by practice. However, most traits that play a role in expert performance can be modified by the right sort of practice, at least during some period of one's lifespan. More generally, there is a complex interplay between genetic factors and practice activities that we are just beginning to understand. Some genetic factors may influence a person's ability to engage in sustained, deliberate practice. For instance, by limiting a person's capability to focus for long periods of time every day. Conversely, engaging in extended practice may influence how genes are turned on and off in the body. The last part of the book takes everything we have learned about deliberate practice by studying expert performers and explains what it means for the rest of us. I offer specific advice about putting deliberate practice to work in professional organizations in order to improve the performance of employees, about how individuals can apply deliberate practice to get better in their areas of interest, and even about how schools can put deliberate practice to work in the classroom. While the principles of deliberate practice were discovered by studying expert performers, the principles themselves can be used by anyone who wants to improve at anything, even if just a little bit. Want to improve your tennis game? Deliberate practice. Your writing? Deliberate practice. Your sales skills? Deliberate practice. Because deliberate practice was developed specifically to help people become among the best in the world at what they do and not merely to become good enough, it is the most powerful approach to learning that has yet been discovered. Here is a good way to think about it. You wish to climb a mountain. You're not sure how high you want to go. That peak looks an awfully long way off, but you know you want to get higher than you currently are. You could simply take off on whatever path looks promising and hope for the best, but you're probably not going to get very far. Or you could rely on a guide who has been to the peak and knows the best way there. That will guarantee that no matter how high you decide to climb, you are doing it in the most efficient, effective way. That best way is deliberate practice, and this book is your guide. It will show you the path to the peak. How far you travel along that path is up to you. Chapter 1. The Power of Purposeful Practice. In just our fourth session together, Steve was already beginning to sound discouraged. It was Thursday of the first week of an experiment that I had expected to last for 2 or 3 months, but from what Steve was telling me, it might not make much sense to go on. "There appears to be a limit for me somewhere around 8 or 9 digits," he told me, his words captured by the tape recorder that ran throughout each of our sessions. "With 9 digits especially, it's very difficult to get, regardless of what pattern I use, you know, my own kind of strategies. It really doesn't matter what I use. It seems very difficult to get." Steve, an undergraduate at Carnegie Mellon University, where I was teaching at the time, had been hired to come in several times a week and work on a simple task: memorizing strings of numbers. I would read him a series of digits at a rate of about 1 per second. 7, 4, 0, 1, 1, 9, and so on. And Steve would try to remember them all and repeat them back to me once I was done. One goal was simply to see how much Steve could improve with practice. Now, after 4 of the hour-long sessions, he could reliably recall 7-digit strings, the length of a local phone number, and he usually got the 8-digit strings right. But 9 digits was hit or miss, and he had never managed to remember a 10-digit string at all. And at this point, given his frustrating experience over the first few sessions, he was pretty sure that he wasn't going to get any better. What Steve didn't know, but I did, was that pretty much all of psychological science at the time indicated that he was right. Decades of research had shown that there was a strict limit to the number of items that a person can retain in short-term memory, which is the type of memory the brain uses to hold on to small amounts of information for a brief period of time. If a friend gives you his address, it is your short-term memory that holds on to it just long enough to write it down. Or if you're multiplying a couple of 2-digit numbers in your head, your short-term memory is where you keep track of all the intermediate pieces. Let's see, 14 times 27. First 4 times 7 is 28, so keep the 8 and carry the 2, then 4 times 2 is 8, and so on. And there's a reason it's called short-term. You're not going to remember that address or those intermediate numbers 5 minutes later unless you spend the time repeating them to yourself over and over again, and thus transfer them into your long-term memory. The problem with short-term memory, and the problem that Steve was coming face-to-face with, is that the brain has strict limits on how many items it can hold in short-term memory at once. For some, it is 6 items. For others, it may be 7 or 8. But the limit is generally about 7 items, enough to hold on to a local phone number, but not a social security number. Long-term memory doesn't have the same limitations. In fact, no one has ever found the upper limits of long-term memory. But it takes much longer to deploy. Given enough time to work on it, you can memorize dozens or even hundreds of phone numbers. But the test I was giving Steve was designed to present digits so fast that he was forced to use only his short-term memory. I was reading the digits at a rate of 1 per second, too fast for him to transfer the digits into his long-term memory, so it was no surprise that he was running into a wall at numbers that were about 8 or 9 digits long. Still, I hoped he might be able to do a little better. The idea for the study had come from an obscure paper I had discovered while searching through old scientific studies. A paper published in a 1929 issue of the American Journal of Psychology by Pauline Martin and Samuel Fernberger, two psychologists at the University of Pennsylvania. Martin and Fernberger reported that 2 undergraduate subjects had been able, with 4 months of practice, to increase the number of digits they could remember when given the digits at a rate of about 1 per second. One of the students had improved from an average of 9 digits to 13, while the other had gone from 11 to 15. This result had been overlooked, or forgotten, by the broader psychological research community, but it immediately captured my attention. Was this sort of improvement really even possible? And if so, how was it possible? Martin and Fernberger had offered no details about how the students had improved their digit memory. But that was exactly the sort of question that most intrigued me. At the time, I was just out of graduate school, and my main area of interest was the mental processes that take place when someone is learning something or developing a skill. For my dissertation, I had honed a psychological research tool called the Think Aloud Protocol that was designed specifically to study such mental processes. So, in collaboration with Bill Chase, a well-known Carnegie Mellon psychology professor, I set out to redo the old Martin and Fernberger study. And this time, I would be watching to see exactly how our subject improved his digit memory. If indeed he did. The subject we had recruited was Steve Falloon, who was about as typical a Carnegie Mellon undergraduate as we could have hoped to find. He was a psychology major who was interested in early childhood development. He had just finished his junior year. His scores on achievement tests were similar to those of other Carnegie Mellon students, while his grades were somewhat higher than average. Tall and thin, with thick, dark blonde hair, he was friendly, outgoing, and enthusiastic. And he was a serious runner, a fact that did not seem meaningful to us at the time, but that would turn out to be crucial to our study. On the first day that Steve showed up for the memory work, his performance was dead on average. He could usually remember 7 digits, and sometimes 8, but no more. It was the same sort of performance he would expect from any random person picked off the street. On Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, he was a little better, an average of just under 9 digits, but still no better than normal. Steve said he thought that the main difference from the first day was that he knew what to expect from the memory test, and thus was more comfortable. It was at the end of that Thursday's session that Steve explained to me why he thought he was unlikely to get any better. Then on Friday, something happened that would change everything. Steve found a way to break through. The training sessions went like this. I would start with a random 5-digit string, and if Steve got it right, which he always did, I would go to 6 digits. If he got that right, we'd go to 7 digits, and so on, increasing the length of the string by 1 each time he got it right. If he got it wrong, I would drop the length of the string by 2 and go again. In this way, Steve was constantly challenged, but not too much. He was given strings of digits that were right at the boundary between what he could and couldn't do. And on that Friday, Steve moved the boundary. Up to that point, he had remembered a 9-digit string correctly only a handful of times, and he had never remembered a 10-digit string correctly. So he had never even had a chance to try strings of 11 digits or longer. But he began that 5th session on a roll. He got the first 3 tries, 5, 6, and 7 digits, right without a problem. Missed the 4th one, then got back on track. 6 digits, right. 7 digits, right. 8 digits, right. 9 digits, right. Then I read out a 10-digit number. 5718866610, and he nailed that one as well. He missed the next string with 11 digits, but after he got another 9 digits and another 10 digits right, I read him a second 11-digit string, 9075662 9867, and this time he repeated the whole thing back to me without a hitch. It was 2 digits more than he had ever gotten right before. And although an additional 2 digits may not seem particularly impressive, it was actually a major accomplishment, because the past several days had established that Steve had a natural ceiling, a number of digits he could comfortably hold in his short-term memory, of only 8 or 9. He had found a way to push through that ceiling. That was the beginning of what was to be the most surprising 2 years of my career. From this point on, Steve slowly but steadily improved his ability to remember strings of digits. By the 60th session, he was able to consistently remember 20 digits, far more than Bill and I had ever imagined he could. After a little more than 100 sessions, he was up to 40, which was more than anyone, even professional mnemonists, had ever achieved. And still, he kept going. He worked with me for another 200 training sessions, and by the end he had reached 82 digits. 82. If you think about that for a moment, you'll realize just how incredible this memory ability truly is. Here are 82 random digits. 032-644-344-960-222-132 8209300120320379182373921722073914 7654 6120179095555300. Imagine hearing all of those read out to you at 1 per second and being able to remember them all. This is what Steve Falloon taught himself to do over the 2 years of our experiment, all without even knowing it was possible, just by continuing to work on it week after week. The rise of extraordinary performers. In 1908, Johnny Hayes won the Olympic marathon in what newspapers at the time described as the greatest race of the century. Hayes's winning time, which set a world record for the marathon, was 2 hours, 55 minutes, and 18 seconds. Today, barely more than a century later, the world record for a marathon is 2 hours, 2 minutes, and 57 seconds, nearly 30% faster than Hayes's record time. And if you're an 18 to 34-year-old male, you aren't even allowed to enter the Boston Marathon unless you've run another marathon in less than 3 hours, 5 minutes. In short, Hayes's world record time in 1908 would qualify him for today's Boston Marathon, which has about 30,000 runners, but with not a lot to spare. That same 1908 Summer Olympics saw a near disaster in the men's diving competition. One of the divers barely avoided serious injury while attempting a double somersault. And an official report released a few months later concluded that the dive was simply too dangerous and recommended that it be banned from future Olympic Games. Today, the double somersault is an entry-level dive, with 10-year-olds nailing it in competitions. And by high school, the best divers are doing 4.5 somersaults. World-class competitors take it even further with dives such as the twister, 2.5 backward somersaults with 2.5 twists added. It's difficult to imagine what those early 20th century experts who found the double somersault dive too dangerous would have thought about the twister. But my guess is that they would have dismissed it as laughably impossible. Assuming, that is, that someone would have had the imagination and the audacity to suggest it in the first place. In the early 1930s, Alfred Cortot was one of the best-known classical musicians in the world, and his recordings of Chopin's 24 Etudes were considered the definitive interpretation. Today, teachers offer those same performances, sloppy and marred by missed notes, as an example of how not to play Chopin, with critics complaining about Cortot's careless technique. And any professional pianist is expected to be able to perform the etudes with far greater technical skill and élan than Cortot. Indeed, Anthony Tomasini, the music critic at the New York Times, once commented that musical ability has increased so much since Cortot's time that Cortot would probably not be admitted to Juilliard now. In 1973, David Richard Spencer of Canada had memorized more digits of pi than any other person before him. 511. 5 years later, after a rapid-fire series of new records set by a handful of people competing to claim the memorization title, the record belonged to an American, David Sanker, who had committed 10,000 digits of pi to memory. In 2015, after another 30-plus years of gains, the recognized title holder was Rajveer Meena of India, who had memorized the first 70,000 digits of pi, an accumulation that took him 24 hours and 4 minutes to recite. Although Akira Haraguchi of Japan had claimed to have memorized an even more incredible 100,000 digits, or nearly 200 times as many as anyone had memorized just 42 years earlier. These are not isolated examples. We live in a world full of people with extraordinary abilities. Abilities that, from the vantage point of almost any other time in human history, would have been deemed impossible. Consider Roger Federer's magic with a tennis ball, or the astounding vault that Michaela Maroney nailed in the 2012 Summer Olympics. A round off onto the springboard, a back handspring onto the vault, and then a high arching flight, with Michaela completing 2.5 twists before she landed firmly and with complete control on the mat. There are chess grandmasters who can play several dozen different games simultaneously while blindfolded, and a seemingly unending supply of young musical prodigies who can do things on the piano, the violin, the cello, or the flute that would have astonished aficionados a century ago. But while the abilities are extraordinary, there is no mystery at all about how these people developed them. They practiced. A lot. The world record time in the marathon wasn't cut by 30% over the course of a century because people were being born with a greater talent for running long distances. Nor did the second half of the 20th century see some sudden surge in the births of people with a gift for playing Chopin or Rachmaninoff, or for memorizing tens of thousands of random digits. What the second half of the 20th century did see was a steady increase in the amount of time that people in different areas devoted to training, combined with a growing sophistication of training techniques. This was true in a huge number of fields, particularly highly competitive fields such as musical performance and dance, individual and team sports, and chess and other competitive games. This increase in the amount and sophistication of practice resulted in a steady improvement in the abilities of the performers in these various fields, an improvement that was not always obvious from year to year, but that is dramatic when viewed over the course of several decades. One of the best, if sometimes bizarre, places to see the results of this sort of practice is in the Guinness World Records. Flip through the pages of the book, or visit the online version, and you will find such record holders as the American teacher Barbara Blackburn, who can type up to 212 words per minute, Marco Ballo of Slovenia, who once rode 562 miles on a bicycle in 24 hours, and Vikas Sharma of India, who in just 1 minute was able to calculate the roots of 12 large numbers, each with between 20 and 51 digits, with the roots ranging from the 17th to the 50th root. That last may be the most impressive of all of them, because Sharma was able to perform 12 exceedingly difficult mental calculations in just 60 seconds, faster than many people could punch the numbers into a calculator and read off the answers. I actually received an email from one Guinness World Record holder, Bob J. Fisher, who at one time held 12 different world records for basketball free throw shooting. His records include such things as the most free throws accomplished in 30 seconds, 33, the most in 10 minutes, 448, and the most in 1 hour, 2,371. Bob wrote to tell me that he had read about my studies of the effects of practice, and had applied what he had learned from those studies in developing his ability to shoot basketball free throws faster than anyone else. Those studies all have their roots in the work that I did with Steve Falloon in the late 1970s. Since that time, I have devoted my career to understanding exactly how practice works to create new and expanded capabilities, with a particular focus on those people who have used practice to become among the best in the world at what they do. And after several decades of studying these best of the best, these expert performers, to use the technical term, I have found that no matter what field you study, music or sports or chess or something else, the most effective types of practice all follow the same set of general principles. There is no obvious reason why this should be the case. Why should the teaching techniques used to turn aspiring musicians into concert pianists have anything to do with the training that a dancer must go through to become a prima ballerina, or the study that a chess player must undertake to become a grandmaster? The answer is that the most effective and most powerful types of practice in any field work by harnessing the adaptability of the human body and brain to create, step by step, the ability to do things that were previously not possible. If you wish to develop a truly effective training method for anything, creating world-class gymnasts, for instance, or even something like teaching doctors to perform laparoscopic surgery, that method will need to take into account what works and what doesn't in driving changes in the body and brain. Thus, all truly effective practice techniques work in essentially the same way. These insights are all relatively new and weren't available to all the teachers, coaches, and performers who produced the incredible improvements in performance that have occurred over the past century. Instead, these advances were all accomplished through trial and error, with the people involved having essentially no idea why a particular training method might be effective. Furthermore, the practitioners in the various fields built their bodies of knowledge in isolation, with no sense that all of this was interconnected, that the ice skater who was working on a triple axel was following the same set of general principles as, say, the pianist working to perfect a Mozart sonata. So imagine what might be possible with efforts that are inspired and directed by a clear scientific understanding of the best ways to build expertise. And imagine what might be possible if we applied the techniques that have proved to be so effective in sports and music and chess to all the different types of learning that people do, from the education of school children to the training of doctors, engineers, pilots, business people, and workers of every sort. I believe that the dramatic improvements we have seen in those few fields over the past 100 years are achievable in pretty much every field if we apply the lessons that can be learned from studying the principles of effective practice. There are various sorts of practice that can be effective to one degree or another. But one particular form, which I named deliberate practice back in the early 1990s, is the gold standard. It is the most effective and powerful form of practice that we know of, and applying the principles of deliberate practice is the best way to design practice methods in any area. We will devote most of the rest of this book to exploring what deliberate practice is, why it is so effective, and how best to apply it in various situations. But before we delve into the details of deliberate practice, it will be best if we spend a little time understanding some more basic types of practice, the sorts of practice that most people have already experienced in one way or another. The usual approach. Let's begin by looking at the way people typically learn a new skill: driving a car, playing the piano, performing long division, drawing a human figure, writing code, or pretty much anything, really. For the sake of having a specific example, let's suppose you were learning to play tennis. You've seen tennis matches played on television, and it looks like fun. Or maybe you have some friends who play tennis and want you to join them. So you buy a couple of tennis outfits, court shoes, maybe a sweatband, and a racket and some balls. Now you're committed, but you don't know the first thing about actually playing tennis. You don't even know how to hold the racket. So you pay for some lessons from a tennis coach, or maybe you just ask one of your friends to show you the basics. After those initial lessons, you know enough to go out on your own and practice. You'll probably spend some time working on your serve, and you practice hitting the ball against a wall over and over again until you're pretty sure that you can hold your own in a game against a wall. After that, you go back to your coach or your friend for another lesson, and then you practice some more. And then another lesson, more practice. And after a while, you've reached the point where you feel competent enough to play against other people. You're still not very good, but your friends are patient, and everyone has a good time. You keep practicing on your own, and getting a lesson every now and then, and over time, the really embarrassing mistakes, like swinging and missing the ball completely, or hitting the ball very solidly straight into your doubles partner's back, become more and more rare. You get better with the various strokes, even the backhand. And occasionally, when everything comes together just so, you even end up hitting a ball like a pro. Or so you tell yourself. You have reached a comfort level at which you can just go out and have fun playing the game. You pretty much know what you're doing, and the strokes have become automatic. You don't have to think too much about any of it. So you play weekend after weekend with your friends, enjoying the game and the exercise. You have become a tennis player. That is, you have learned tennis in the traditional sense, where the goal is to reach a point at which everything becomes automatic and an acceptable performance is possible with relatively little thought, so that you can just relax and enjoy the game. At this point, even if you're not completely satisfied with your level of play, your improvement stalls. You have mastered the easy stuff. But, as you quickly discover, you still have weaknesses that don't disappear no matter how often you play with your friends. Perhaps, for example, every time you use a backstroke to hit a ball that is coming in chest high with a bit of spin, you miss the shot. You know this, and the cagier of your opponents have noticed this too, so it is frustrating. However, because it doesn't happen very often and you never know when it's coming, you never get a chance to consciously work on it. So you keep missing the shot in exactly the same way as you manage to hit other shots, automatically. We all follow pretty much the same pattern with any skill we learn, from baking a pie to writing a descriptive paragraph. We start off with a general idea of what we want to do, get some instruction from a teacher or a coach, or a book, or a website, practice until we reach an acceptable level, and then let it become automatic. And there's nothing wrong with that. For much of what we do in life, it's perfectly fine to reach a middling level of performance and just leave it like that. If all you want to do is to safely drive your car from point A to point B, to play the piano well enough to plink out Für Elisa, then this approach to learning is all you need. But there is one very important thing to understand here. Once you have reached this satisfactory skill level and automated your performance, your driving, your tennis playing, your baking of pies, you have stopped improving. People often misunderstand this because they assume that the continued driving or tennis playing or pie baking is a form of practice, and that if they keep doing it, they are bound to get better at it, slowly perhaps, but better nonetheless. They assume that someone who has been driving for 20 years must be a better driver than someone who has been driving for 5. That a doctor who has been practicing medicine for 20 years must be a better doctor than one who has been practicing for 5. That a teacher who has been teaching for 20 years must be better than one who has been teaching for 5. But no. Research has shown that, generally speaking, once a person reaches that level of acceptable performance and automaticity, the additional years of practice don't lead to improvement. If anything, the doctor or the teacher or the driver who's been at it for 20 years is likely to be a bit worse than the one who's been doing it for only 5. And the reason is that these automated abilities gradually deteriorate in the absence of deliberate efforts to improve. So, what do you do if you're not satisfied with this automated level of performance? What if you were a teacher with 10 years in the classroom and you want to do something to better engage your students and get your lessons across more effectively? A weekend golfer, and you would like to move beyond your 18 handicap? An advertising copywriter, and you want to add a little wow to your words? This is the same situation that Steve Falloon found himself in after just a couple of sessions. At that point, he'd become comfortable with the task of hearing a string of digits, holding them in his memory, and repeating them back to me, and he was performing about as well as could be expected, given what is known about the limitations of short-term memory. He could have just kept doing what he was doing and maxing out at 8 or 9 digits session after session. But he didn't, because he was participating in an experiment in which he was constantly being challenged to remember just one more digit than the last time. And because he was naturally the sort of guy who liked this sort of challenge, Steve pushed himself to get better. The approach that he took, which we will call purposeful practice, turned out to be incredibly successful for him. It isn't always so successful, as we shall see, but it is more effective than the usual just-enough method, and it is a step toward deliberate practice, which is our ultimate goal. Purposeful practice. Purposeful practice has several characteristics that set it apart from what we might call naive practice, which is essentially just doing something repeatedly and expecting that the repetition alone will improve one's performance. Steve Wary, a specialist in music education at Wichita State University, once offered the following imaginary conversation between a music instructor and a young music student. It's the sort of conversation about practice that music instructors have all the time. In this case, a teacher is trying to figure out why a young student has not been improving. Teacher, your practice sheet says that you practice an hour a day, but your playing test was only a C. Can you explain why? Student, I don't know what happened. I could play the test last night. Teacher, how many times did you play it? Student, 10 or 20. Teacher, how many times did you play it correctly? Student, I don't know, once or twice? Teacher, huh, how did you practice it? Student, I don't know, I just played it. This is naive practice in a nutshell. I just played it. I just swung the bat and tried to hit the ball. I just listened to the numbers and tried to remember them. I just read the math problems and tried to solve them. Purposeful practice is, as the term implies, much more